After darkness had fallen, and when the stores and equipment had all been safely unloaded and stood in waiting on the quay, Father Coram and Lyra walked along the waterfront and looked for Einarsson's bar. They found it easily enough, a crude concrete shed with a red neon sign flashing irregularly over the door and the sound of loud voices through the condensation-frosted windows. A pitted alley beside it led to a sheet metal gate into a rear yard, where a lean-to shed stood crazily over a floor of frozen mud. Dim yellow light through the rear window of the bar showed a vast, pale form, crouching upright and gnawing at a haunch of meat which it held in both hands. Lyra had an impression of blood-stained muzzle and face, small malevolent black eyes, and an immensity of dirty, matted, yellowish fur. As it gnawed, hideous growling, crunching, sucking noises came from it. Father Coram stood by the gate and called.
Yorak Burenism?
The bear stopped eating. As far as they could tell, he was looking at them directly, but it was impossible to read any expression on his face.
Yorak Burenison? May I speak to you?
Lyra's heart was thumping hard, because something in the bear's presence made her feel close to coldness, danger, brutal power, but a power controlled by intelligence. And not a human intelligence, nothing like a human, because, of course, bears had no demons. This strange, hulking presence gnawing its meat was like nothing she had ever imagined, and she felt a profound admiration and pity for the lonely creature. He dropped the reindeer leg in the dirt and slumped on all fours to the gate. Then he reared up massively, 10 feet or more high, as if to show how mighty he was, to remind them how useless the gate would be as a barrier, and he spoke to them from that height.
Well, who are you?
His voice was so deep it seemed to shake the earth. The rank smell that came from his body was almost overpowering.
I'm Father Coram, from the Egyptian people of Eastern Anglia, and this little girl is Lyra Belacqua.
What do you want?
We want to offer you employment, Yorick Burnison.
I am employed.
The bear dropped on all fours again. It was very hard to detect any expressive tones in his voice, whether of irony or anger, because it was so deep and so flat.
What do you do at the sledge depot?
I mend broken machinery and articles of iron. I lift heavy objects.
What kind of work is that for a Panzerbjörn?
Paid work.
Behind the bear, the door of the bar opened a little way and a man put down a large earthenware jar before looking up to peer at them.
Who's that?
He said.
Strangers,
said the bear. The bartender looked as if he was going to ask something more, but the bear lurched towards him suddenly and the man shut the door in alarm. The bear hooked a claw through the handle of the jar and lifted it to his mouth. Lyra could smell the tang of the raw spirits that splashed out. After swallowing several times, the bear put the jar down and turned back to gnaw his haunch of meat, heedless of Father Coram and Lyra, it seemed. But then he spoke again.
What work are you offering?
Fighting, in all probability. We're moving north until we find a place where they've taken some children captive. When we find it, we'll have to fight to get the children free, and then we'll bring them back.
And what will you pay?
I don't know what to offer you, Yorick Burnison. If gold is desirable to you, we have gold.
No good.
What do they pay you at the sledge depot?
My keep here in meat and spirits.
Silence from the bear. And then he dropped the ragged bone and lifted the jar to his muzzle again, drinking the powerful spirits like water.
Forgive me for asking, Yorick Burnison. But you could live a free, proud life on the ice, hunting seals and walruses, or you could go to war and win great prizes. What ties you to Trollesund and Einarsson's bar?
Lyra felt her skin shiver all over. She would have thought a question like that, which was almost an insult, would enrage the great creature beyond reason, and she wondered at Father Coram's courage in asking it. Yorick Burnison put down his jar and came close to the gate to peer at the old man's face. Father Coram didn't flinch.
I know the people you are seeking, the child cutters. They left town the day before yesterday to go north with more children. No one will tell you about them. They pretend not to see because the child cutters bring money and business. Now, I don't like the child cutters, so I shall answer you politely. I stay here and drink spirits, because the men here took my armor away, and without that, I can hunt seals, but I can't go to war. And I am an armored bear. War is the sea I swim in and the air I breathe. The men of this town gave me spirits and let me drink till I was asleep, and then they took my armor away from me. If I knew where they keep it, I would tear down the town to get it back. If you want my service, the price is this. Get me back my armor. Do that, and I shall serve you in your campaign, either until I am dead or until you have a victory. The price is my armor. I want it back, and then I shall never need spirits again.
Chapter 11. Armor. When they returned to the ship, Far Decorum and John Farr and the other leaders spent a long time in conference in the saloon, and Lyra went to her cabin to consult the alethiometer. Within 5 minutes she knew exactly where the bear's armor was, and why it would be difficult to get it back. She wondered whether to go to the saloon and tell John Farr and the others, but decided that they'd ask her if they wanted to know. Perhaps they knew already. She lay on her bunk thinking of that savage, mighty bear, and the careless way he drank his fiery spirit, and the loneliness of him in his dirty lean-to. How different it was to be human, with one's demon always there to talk to. In the silence of the still ship, without the continual creak of metal and timber, or the rumble of the engine, or the rush of water along the side, Lyra gradually fell asleep, with Pantalaimon on her pillow, sleeping too. She was dreaming of her great imprisoned father when suddenly, for no reason at all, she woke up. She had no idea what time it was. There was a faint light in the cabin that she took for moonlight, and it showed her new cold-weather furs that lay stiffly in the corner of the cabin. No sooner did she see them than she longed to try them on again. Once they were on, she had to go out on deck, and a minute later she opened the door at the top of the companionway and stepped out. At once she saw that something strange was happening in the sky. She thought it was clouds, moving and trembling under a nervous agitation, but Pantalaimon whispered,
"The aurora!"
Her wonder was so strong that she had to clutch the rail to keep from falling. The sight filled the northern sky. The immensity of it was scarcely conceivable. As if from heaven itself, great curtains of delicate light hung and trembled. Pale green and rose pink, and as transparent as the most fragile fabric, and at the bottom edge a profound and fiery crimson like the fires of hell, they swung and shimmered loosely with more grace than the most skillful dancer. Lyra thought she could even hear them, a vast, distant, whispering swish. In the evanescent delicacy she felt something as profound as she'd felt close to the bear. She was moved by it. It was so beautiful it was almost holy. She felt tears prick her eyes, and the tears splintered the light even further into prismatic rainbows. It wasn't long before she found herself entering the same kind of trance as when she consulted the alethiometer. Perhaps, she thought calmly, whatever moves the alethiometer's needle is making the aurora glow too. It might even be dust itself. She thought that without noticing that she thought it, and she soon forgot it, and only remembered it much later. And as she gazed, the image of a city seemed to form itself behind the veils and streams of translucent colour. Towers and domes, honey-coloured temples and colonnades, broad boulevards and sunlit parkland. Looking at it gave her a sense of vertigo, as if she were looking not up but down, and across a gulf so wide that nothing could ever pass over it. It was a whole universe away. But something was moving across it, and as she tried to focus her eyes on the movement, she felt faint and dizzy, because the little thing moving wasn't part of the aurora or of the other universe behind it. It was in the sky over the roofs of the town. When she could see it clearly, she had come fully awake, and the sky city was gone. The flying thing came closer and circled the ship on outspread wings. Then it glided down and landed with brisk sweeps of its powerful pinions and came to a halt on the wooden deck a few yards from Lyra. In the aurora's light she saw a great bird, a beautiful grey goose whose head was crowned with a flash of pure white. And yet it wasn't a bird. It was a demon, though there was no one in sight but Lyra herself. The idea filled her with sickly fear. The bird said,
"Where is Father Coram?"
And suddenly Lyra realized who it must be. This was the demon of Serafina Pekala, the clan queen, Father Coram's witch friend. She stammered to reply,
I'll go and get him.
She turned and scampered down the companionway to the cabin Father Coram occupied and opened the door to speak into the darkness.
Father Coram, the witch's demon's come. He's waiting on the deck. He flew here all by himself. I seen him coming in the sky.
Ask him to wait on the after deck, child.
The goose made his stately way to the stern of the ship, where he looked around, elegant and wild simultaneously, and a cause of fascinated terror to Lyra, who felt as though she were entertaining a ghost. Then Father Coram came up, wrapped in his cold weather gear, closely followed by John Farr. Both old men bowed respectfully, and their demons also acknowledged the visitor.
Greetings, and I'm happy and proud to see you again, Geyser. Now, would you like to come inside, or would you prefer to stay out here in the open?
I would rather stay outside, thank you, Father Coram. Are you warm enough for a while?
Witches and their demons felt no cold, but they were aware that other humans did. Father Coram assured him that they were well wrapped up, and said,
How is Serafina Pekala?
She sends her greetings to you, Father Coram, and she is well and strong. Who are these two people?
Father Coram introduced them both. The goose demon looked hard at Lyra.
I have heard of this child. She is talked about among witches. So you have come to make war.
Not war, Geyser. We're going to free the children taken from us. And I hope the witches will help.
Not all of them will. Some clans are working with the Dust Hunters.
Is that what you call the Oblation Board?
I don't know what this board may be. They are Dust Hunters. They came to our regions 10 years ago with philosophical instruments. They paid us to allow them to set up stations in our lands, and they treated us with courtesy.
What is this dust?
It comes from the sky. Some say it has always been there. Some say it is newly falling. What is certain is that when people become aware of it, a great fear comes over them, and they'll stop at nothing to discover what it is. But it is not of any concern to witches.
And where are they now, these dust hunters?
4 days northeast of here, at a place called Bolvangar. Our clan made no agreement with them, and because of our long-standing obligation to you, Father Coram, I have come to show you how to find these dust hunters.
Father Coram smiled, and John Farr clapped his great hands together in satisfaction.
Thank you kindly, sir. But tell us this. Do you know anything more about these dust hunters? What do they do at this Bolvangar?
They have put up buildings of metal and concrete and some underground chambers. They burn coal spirit, which they bring in at great expense. We don't know what they do, but there is an air of hatred and fear over the place and for miles around. Witches can see these things where other humans can't. Animals keep away, too. No birds fly there. Lemmings and foxes have fled. Hence the name, Bolvangar. The Fields of Evil. They don't call it that. They call it the station. But to everyone else it is Bolvangar.
And how are they defended?
They have a company of northern Tartars armed with rifles. They're good soldiers, but they lack practice because no one has ever attacked the settlement since it was built. Then there is a wire fence around the compound, which is filled with Anbaric force. There may be other means of defense that we don't know about. Because, as I say, they have no interest for us.
Lyra was bursting to ask a question, and the goose demon knew it and looked at her as if giving permission.
Why do the witches talk about me?
Because of your father and his knowledge of the other worlds.
That surprised all three of them. Lyra looked at Father Coram, who looked back in mild wonder, and at John Farr, whose expression was troubled.
Other worlds? Well, pardon me, sir, but what worlds would those be? Do you mean the stars?
Indeed, no.
Perhaps the world of spirits?
Nor that.
Is it the city in the lights? It is, ain't it?
The goose turned his stately head towards her. His eyes were black, surrounded by a thin line of pure sky blue, and their gaze was intense.
Yes. Witches have known of the other worlds for thousands of years. You can see them sometimes in the northern lights. They aren't part of this universe at all. Even the furthest stars are part of this universe. But the lights show us a different universe entirely. Not further away, but interpenetrating with this one. Here, on this deck, millions of other universes exist, unaware of one another.
He raised his wings and spread them wide before folding them again.
There. I have just brushed 10 million other worlds, and they knew nothing of it. We are as close as a heartbeat. But we can never touch or see or hear these other worlds except in the Northern Lights.
And why there?
Because the charged particles in the aurora have the property of making the matter of this world thin, so that we can see through it for a brief time. Witches have always known this, but we seldom speak of it.
My father believes in it. I know because I heard him talking and showing pictures of the aurora.
Is this anything to do with dust?
Who can say? All I can tell you is that the dust hunters are as frightened of it as if it were deadly poison. That is why they imprisoned Lord Asriel.
But why?
They think he intends to use dust in some way in order to make a bridge between this world and the world beyond the aurora.
There was a lightness in Lyra's head. She heard Father Coram say,
And does he?
Yes. They don't believe he can because they think he is mad to believe in the other worlds in the first place. But it is true. That is his intention. And he is so powerful a figure that they feared he would upset their own plans. So they made a pact with the armored bears to capture him and keep him imprisoned in the fortress of Svalbard, out of the way. Some say they helped the new bear king to gain his throne as part of the bargain.
Do the witches want him to make this bridge? Are they on his side or against him?
That is a question with too complicated an answer. Firstly, the witches are not united. There are differences of opinion among us. Secondly, Lord Asriel's bridge will have a bearing on a war being waged at the present between some witches and various other forces, some in the spirit world. Possession of the bridge, if it ever existed, would give a huge advantage to whoever held it. Thirdly, Serafina Pekala's clan, my clan, is not yet part of any alliance, though great pressure is being put on us to declare for one side or another. You see, these are questions of high politics and not easily answered.
What about the bears? Whose side are they on?
On the side of anyone who pays them. They have no interest whatever in these questions. They have no demons. They are unconcerned about human problems. At least that is how bears used to be. But we have heard that their new king is intent on changing their old ways. At any rate, the dust hunters have paid them to imprison Lord Asriel, and they will hold him on Svalbard until the last drop of blood drains from the body of the last bear alive.
But not all bears. There's one who ain't on Svalbard at all. He's an outcast bear, and he's going to come with us.
The goose gave Lyra another of his piercing looks. This time she could feel his cold surprise. Father Coram shifted uncomfortably and said,
The fact is, Lyra, I don't think he is. We heard he's serving out the term as an indentured labourer. He ain't free, as we thought he might be. He's under sentence. Till he's discharged, he won't be free to come, armour or no armour. And he won't never have that back either.
But he said they tricked him. They made him drunk and stole it away.
We heard a different story. He's a dangerous rogue, is what we heard.
If...
Lyra was passionate. She could hardly speak for indignation.
If the alethiometer says something, I know it's true. And I asked it, and it said that he was telling the truth. They did trick him, and they're telling lies and not him. I believe him, Lord Farr. Farr Decorum, you saw him too, and you believe him, don't you?
I thought I did, child. I ain't so certain of things as you are.
But what are they afraid of? Do they think he's going to go round killing people as soon as he gets his armour on? He could kill dozens of them now.
He has done. Well, if not dozens, then some. When they first took his armour away, he went a-rampaging round looking for it. He tore open the police house and the bank and I don't know where else, and there's at least 2 men who died. The only reason they didn't shoot to kill him is because of his wondrous skill with metals. They wanted to use him like a labourer.
Like a slave? They hadn't got the right.
Be that as it may, they might have shot him for the killings he'd done, but they didn't. and they bound him over to labour in the town's interest until he's paid off the damage in the blood money.
John, I don't know how you feel, but it's my belief they'll never let him have that armour back. The longer they keep him, the more angry he'll be when he gets it.
But if we get his armour back, he'll come with us and never bother him again. I promise, Lord Farr.
And how are we going to do that?
I know where it is.
There was a silence, in which they all three became aware of the witch's demon and his fixed stare at Lyra. All three turned to him, and their own demons too, who had until then affected the extreme politeness of keeping their eyes modestly away from this singular creature, here without his body.
You won't be surprised to know that the alethiometer is the other reason the witches are interested in you, Lyra. Our consul told us about your visit this morning. I believe it was Dr. Lancelius who told you about the bear.
Yes, it was. And she and Father Coram went themselves and talked to him. I dare say what Lyra says is true, but if we go breaking the law of these people, we'll only get involved in a quarrel with them. And what we ought to be doing is pushing on towards this Bolvanger, bear or no bear.
Ah, but you ain't seen him, John, and I do believe Lyra. We could promise on his behalf, maybe. He might make all the difference.
What do you think, sir?
We have few dealings with bears. Their desires are as strange to us as ours are to them. If this bear is an outcast, he might be less reliable than they are said to be. You must decide for yourselves.
We will. But now, sir, can you tell us how to get to Bolvanger from here?
The goose demon began to explain. He spoke of valleys and hills, of the tree line and the tundra, of star sightings. Lyra listened a while and then lay back in the deck chair with Pantalaimon curled around her neck and thought of the grand vision the goose demon had brought with him. A bridge between two worlds. This was far more splendid than anything she could have hoped for, and only her great father could have conceived it. As soon as they had rescued the children, she would go to Svalbard with the bear and take Lord Asriel the alethiometer and use it to help set him free. And they'd build the bridge together and be the first across. Sometime in the night, John Farr must have carried Lyra to her bunk, because that was where she awoke. The dim sun was as high in the sky as it was going to get, only a hand's breadth above the horizon, so it must be nearly noon, she thought. Soon, when they moved further north, there would be no sun at all. She dressed quickly and ran on deck to find nothing very much happening. All the stores had been unloaded, sledges and dog teams had been hired and were waiting to go. Everything was ready and nothing was moving. Most of the Egyptians were sitting in a smoke-filled cafe facing the water, eating spice cakes and drinking strong sweet coffee at the long wooden tables under the fizz and crackle of some ancient Anbaric lights.
"Where's Lord Farr?"
she said, sitting down with Tony Costa and his friends.
"And Farr de Coram? Are they getting the bear's armour for him?"
"They're a-talking to the Sisselman. That's their word for governor. You've seen this bear then, Lyra?"
"Yeah,"
she said, and explained all about him. As she talked, someone else pulled a chair up and joined the group at the table.
"So, you've spoken to old Yorick."
She looked at the newcomer with surprise. He was a tall, lean man with a thin black moustache and narrow blue eyes, and a perpetual expression of distant and sardonic amusement. She felt strongly about him at once, but she wasn't sure whether it was liking she felt or dislike. His demon was a shabby hare, as thin and tough-looking as he was. He held out his hand and she shook it warily.
"Lee Scoresby."
"The aeronaut! Where's your balloon? Can I go up in it?"
"It's packed away right now, miss. You must be the famous Lyra. How did you get on with Yorick Bjornason?"
"You know him?"
"I fought beside him in the Tunguska campaign. Hell, I've known Yorick for years. Bears are difficult critters no matter what, but he's a problem and no mistake. Say, are any of you gentlemen in the mood for a game of hazard?"
A pack of cards had appeared from nowhere in his hand. He riffled them with a snapping noise.
"Now, I've heard of the card power of your people,"
Lee Scoresby was saying, cutting and folding the cards over and over with one hand and fishing a cigar out of his breast pocket with the other.
"And I thought you wouldn't object to giving a simple Texan traveler the chance to joust with your skill and daring on the field of pasteboard combat. What do you say, gentlemen?"
Egyptians prided themselves on their ability with cards, and several of the men looked interested and pulled their chairs up. While they were agreeing with Lee Scoresby what to play and for what stakes, his demon flicked her ears at Pantalaimon, who understood, and leapt to her side, lightly as a squirrel. She was speaking for Lyra's ears, too, of course, and Lyra heard her say quietly,
"Go straight to the bear and tell him direct. As soon as they know what's going on, they'll move his armor somewhere else."
Lyra got up, taking her spice cake with her, and no one noticed. Lee Scoresby was already dealing the cards, and every suspicious eye was on his hands. In the dull light, fading through an endless afternoon, she found her way to the sledge depot. It was something she knew she had to do, but she felt uneasy about it, and afraid, too. Outside the largest of the concrete sheds, the great bear was working, and Lyra stood by the open gate to watch. Yorick Birnison was dismantling a gas engine tractor that had crashed. The metal covering of the engine was twisted and buckled, and one runner bent upward. The bear lifted the metal off as if it were cardboard, and turned it this way and that in his great hands, seeming to test it for some quality or other, before setting a rear paw on one corner and then bending the whole sheet in such a way that the dents sprang out and the shape was restored. Leaning it against the wall, he lifted the massive weight of the tractor with one paw and laid it on its side before bending to examine the crumpled runner. As he did so, he caught sight of Lyra. She felt a bolt of cold fear strike at her because he was so massive and so alien. She was gazing through the chain-link fence about 40 yards from him, and she thought how he could clear the distance in a bound or two and sweep the wire aside like a cobweb, and she almost turned and ran away. But Pantalaimon said,
"Stop! Let me go and talk to him."
He was a tern, and before she could answer, he'd flown off the fence and down to the icy ground beyond it. There was an open gate a little way along, and Lyra could have followed him, but she hung back uneasily. Pantalaimon looked at her, and then became a badger. She knew what he was doing. Demons could move no more than a few yards from their humans, and if she stood by the fence and he remained a bird, he wouldn't get near the bear. So he was going to pull. She felt angry and miserable. His badger claws dug into the earth and he walked forward. It was such a strange, tormenting feeling when your demon was pulling at the link between you. Part physical pain deep in the chest, part intense sadness and love. And she knew it was the same for him. Everyone tested it when they were growing up, seeing how far they could pull apart, coming back with intense relief. He tugged a little harder.
"Don't, Pan!"
But he didn't stop. The bear watched, motionless. The pain in Lyra's heart grew more and more unbearable, and a sob of longing rose in her throat.
"Pan!"
Then she was through the gate, scrambling over the icy mud towards him, and he turned into a wildcat and sprang up into her arms, and they were clinging together tightly with little shaky sounds of unhappiness coming from them both.
"I thought you really would."
"No.
I couldn't believe how much it hurt."
And then she brushed the tears away angrily and sniffed hard. He nestled in her arms, and she knew she would rather die than let them be parted and face that sadness again. It would send her mad with grief and terror. If she died, they'd still be together, like the scholars in the crypt at Jordan. Then girl and demon looked up at the solitary bear. He had no demon. He was alone, always alone. She felt such a stir of pity and gentleness for him that she almost reached out to touch his matted pelt, and only a sense of courtesy towards those cold, ferocious eyes prevented her.
"Yorick Birnison?"
"Well?"
"Lord Farr and Farr Decorum have gone to try and get your armor for you."
He didn't move or speak. It was clear what he thought of their chances.
"I know where it is, though. And if I told you, maybe you could get it by yourself. I don't know."
"How do you know where it is?"
"I got a symbol reader. I think I ought to tell you, Yorick Birnison. Seeing as they tricked you out of it in the first place, I don't think that's right. They shouldn't have done that. Lord Farr's going to argue with the Sisselmen, but probably they won't let you have it, whatever he says. So if I tell you, will you come with us and help rescue the kids from Bolvanger?"
"Yes."
"I..."
She didn't mean to be nosy, but she couldn't help being curious. She said,
"Why don't you just make some more armor out of this metal here, Yorick Birnison?"
"Because it's worthless. Look,"
he said, and lifting the engine cover with one paw, he extended a claw on the other hand and ripped right through it like a can opener.
"My armor is made of sky iron, made for me. A bear's armor is his soul, just as your demon is your soul. You might as well take him away,"
indicating Pantalaimon,
"and replace him with a doll full of sawdust. That is the difference. Now, where is my armor?
Listen, you've got to promise not to take vengeance. They done wrong taking it, but you just got to put up with that.
All right, no vengeance afterwards. But no holding back as I take it, either. If they fight, they die.
It's hidden in the cellar of the priest's house. He thinks there's a spirit in it, and he's been a-trying to conjure it out. But that's where it is.
He stood high up on his hind legs and looked west, so that the last of the sun coloured his face a creamy, brilliant yellow-white amid the gloom. She could feel the power of the great creature coming off him like waves of heat.
I must work till sunset. I gave my word this morning to the master here. I still owe a few minutes' work.
The sun's set where I am,
she pointed out, because from her point of view it had vanished behind the rocky headland to the southwest. He dropped to all fours.
It's true,
he said, with his face now in shadow like hers.
What's your name, child?
Lyra Belacqua.
Then I owe you a debt, Lyra Belacqua.
He turned and lurched away, padding so swiftly across the freezing ground that Lyra couldn't keep up, even running. She did run, though, and Pantalaimon flew up as a seagull to watch where the bear went and called down to tell her where to follow. Yorick Birnison bounded out of the depot and along the narrow street before turning into the main street of the town, past the courtyard of the Sisselman's residence where a flag hung in the still air and a sentry marched stiffly up and down, down the hill past the end of the street where the witch consul lived. The sentry by this time had realized what was happening and was trying to gather his wits, but Yorick Birnison was already turning a corner near the harbour. People stopped to watch or scuttled out of his careering way. The sentry fired two shots in the air and set off down the hill after the bear, spoiling the effect by skidding on the icy slope and only regaining his balance after seizing the nearest railings. Lyra was not far behind. As she passed the Sisselman's house, she was aware of a number of figures coming out into the courtyard to see what was going on, and thought she saw Father Coram among them. But then she was passed, hurtling down the street towards the corner where the sentry was already turning to follow the bear. The priest's house was older than most, and made of costly bricks. Three steps led up to the front door, which was now hanging in matchwood splinters, and from inside the house came screams and the crashing and tearing of more wood. The sentry hesitated outside, his rifle at the ready. But then, as passers-by began to gather and people looked out of windows from across the street, he realized that he had to act, and fired a shot into the air before running in. A moment later, the whole house seemed to shake. Glass broke in three windows and a tile slid off the roof, and then a maidservant ran out, terrified, her clucking hen of a demon flapping after her. Another shot came from inside the house, and then a full-throated roar made the servant scream. As if fired from a cannon, the priest himself came hurtly out, with his pelican demon in a wild flutter of feathers and injured pride. Lyra heard orders shouted and turned to see a squad of armed policemen hurrying round the corner, some with pistols and some with rifles, and not far behind them came John Farr and the stout, fussy figure of the Sisselman. A rending, splintering sound made them all look back at the house. A window at ground level, obviously opening on a cellar, was being wrenched apart with a crash of glass and a screech of tearing wood. The sentry who'd followed Yorick Birnison into the house came running out and stood to face the cellar window, rifle at his shoulder, and then the window tore open completely, and out climbed Yorick Birnison, the bear in armour. Without it, he was formidable. With it, he was terrifying. It was rust-red and crudely riveted together, great sheets and plates of dented, discoloured metal that scraped and screeched as they rode over one another. The helmet was pointed like his muzzle, with slits for eyes, and it left the lower part of his jaw bare for tearing and biting. The sentry fired several shots, and the policemen levelled their weapons too, but Yorick Birnison merely shook the bullets off like raindrops and lunged forwards in a screech and clang of metal before the sentry could escape and knocked him to the ground. His demon, a husky dog, darted at the bear's throat, but Yorick Birnison took no more notice of him than he would of a fly, and dragging the sentry to him with one vast paw, he bent and enclosed his head in his jaws. Lyra could see exactly what would happen next. He'd crush the man's skull like an egg, and there would follow a bloody fight, more deaths and more delay, and they would never get free, with or without the bear. Without even thinking, she darted forward and put her hand on the one vulnerable spot in the bear's armour, the gap that appeared between the helmet and the great plate over his shoulders when he bent his head, where she could see the yellow-white fur dimly between the rusty edges of metal. She dug her fingers in, and Pantalaimon instantly flew to the same spot and became a wildcat, crouched to defend her. But Yorick Birnison was still, and the riflemen held their fire.
Yorick, listen. You owe me a debt, right? Well, now you can repay it. Do as I ask. Don't fight these men. Just turn around and walk away with me. We want you, Yorick. You can't stay here. Just come down to the harbour with me and don't even look back. Far Decorum and Lord Far, let them do the talking. They'll make it all right. Leave go this man and come away with me.
The bear slowly opened his jaws. The sentry's head, bleeding and wet and ash-pale, fell to the ground as he fainted, and his demon set about calming and gentling him as the bear stepped away beside Lyra. No one else moved. They watched the bear turn away from his victim at the bidding of the girl with the cat demon, and then they shuffled aside to make room as Yorick Birnison padded heavily through the midst of them at Lyra's side and made for the harbour. Her mind was all on him, and she didn't see the confusion behind her, the fear and the anger that rose up safely when he was gone. She walked with him, and Pantalaimon padded ahead of them both, as if to clear the way. When they reached the harbour, Yorick Birnison dipped his head and unfastened the helmet with a claw, letting it clang on the frozen ground. Egyptians came out of the cafe, having sensed that something was going on, and watched in the gleam of the Anbaric lights on the ship's deck as Yorick Birnison shrugged off the rest of his armour and left it in a heap on the quayside. Without a word to anyone, he padded to the water and slipped into it without a ripple, and vanished.
"What's happened?"
said Tony Costa, hearing the indignant voices from the streets above as the townsfolk and the police made their way to the harbour. Lyra told him as clearly as she could.
"But where's he gone now? He ain't just left his armour on the ground. They'll have it back as soon as they get here."
Lyra was afraid they might, too, for around the corner came the first policeman, and then more, and then the Sisselman and the priest and 20 or 30 onlookers with John Farr and Far Decorum trying to keep up. But when they saw the group on the quayside, they stopped, for someone else had appeared. Sitting on the bear's armour, with one ankle resting on the opposite knee, was the long-limbed form of Lee Scoresby, and in his hand was the longest pistol Lyra had ever seen, casually pointing at the ample stomach of the Sisselman.
"Seems to me you ain't taking very good care of my friend's armor. Why, look at the rust. And I wouldn't be surprised to find moths in it, too. Now, you just stand where you are, still and easy, and don't anybody move till the bear comes back with some lubrication. Or I guess you could all go home and read the newspapers. Up to you."
"There he is,"
said Tony, pointing to a ramp at the far end of the quay, where Yorick Birnison was emerging from the water, dragging something dark with him. Once he was up on the quayside, he shook himself, sending great sheets of water flying in all directions till his fur was standing up thickly again. Then he bent to take the black object in his teeth once more and dragged it along to where his armour lay. It was a dead seal.
"Yorick,"
said the aeronaut, standing up lazily and keeping his pistol firmly fixed on the Sisselman.
"Howdy."
The bear looked up and growled briefly, before ripping the seal open with one claw. Lyra watched fascinated as he laid the skin out flat and tore off strips of blubber, which he then rubbed all over his armour, packing it carefully into the places where the plates moved over one another.
"Are you with these people?"
the bear said to Lee Scoresby as he worked.
"Sure. I guess we're both hired hands, Yorick."
"Where's your balloon?"
"Packed away in two sledges. Here comes the boss."
John Farr and Far Decorum, together with the Sisselman, came down the quay with four armed policemen.
"Bear,"
said the Sisselman in a high, harsh voice.
"For now you're allowed to depart in the company of these people. But let me tell you that if you appear within the town limits again, you will be treated mercilessly."
Yorick Birnison took not the slightest notice, but continued to rub the seal blubber all over his armour, the care and attention he was paying the task reminding Lyra of her own devotion to Pantalaimon. Just as the bear had said, the armour was his soul. The Sisselman and the policeman withdrew, and slowly the other townspeople turned and drifted away, though a few remained to watch. John Farr put his hands to his mouth and called,
"Egyptians!"
They were all ready to move. They had been itching to get underway ever since they had disembarked. The sledges were packed, the dog teams were in their traces.
"Time to move out, friends. We're all assembled now, and the road lies open. Mr. Scoresby, you all are loaded?"
"Ready to go, Lord Farr."
"And you, Yorick Birnison?"
"When I am clad."
He had finished oiling the armour. Not wanting to waste the seal meat, he lifted the carcass in his teeth and flipped it onto the back of Lee Scoresby's larger sledge before donning the armour. It was astonishing to see how lightly he dealt with it. The sheets of metal were almost an inch thick in places, and yet he swung them round and into place as if they were silk robes. It took him less than a minute, and this time there was no harsh scream of rust. So in less than half an hour, the expedition was on its way northward. Under a sky peopled with millions of stars and a glaring moon, the sledges bumped and clattered over the ruts and stones until they reached clear snow at the edge of town. Then the sound changed to a quiet crunch of snow and creak of timber, and the dogs began to step out eagerly, and the motion became swift and smooth. Lyra, wrapped up so thickly in the back of Fardacorum's sledge that only her eyes were exposed, whispered to Pantalaimon.
Can you see Yorick?
He's padding along beside Lee Scoresby's sledge,
the demon replied, looking back in his ermine form as he clung to her wolverine fur hood. Ahead of them, over the mountains to the north, the pale arcs and loops of the northern lights began to glow and tremble. Lyra saw through half-closed eyes and felt a sleepy thrill of perfect happiness to be speeding north under the aurora. Pantalaimon struggled against her sleepiness, but it was too strong. He curled up as a mouse inside her hood. He could tell her when they woke, and it was probably a marten or a dream or some kind of harmless local spirit. But something was following the train of sledges, swinging lightly from branch to branch of the close clustering pine trees, and it put him uneasily in mind of a monkey. Chapter 12. The Lost Boy. They travelled for several hours and then stopped to eat. While the men were lighting fires and melting snow for water, with Yorick Birnison watching Lee Scoresby roast seal meat close by, John Farr spoke to Lyra.
Lyra, can you see that instrument to read it?
The moon itself had long set. The light from the aurora was brighter than moonlight, but it was inconstant. However, Lyra's eyes were keen, and she fumbled inside her furs and tugged out the black velvet bag.
Yes, I can see all right. But I know where most of the symbols are by now anyway. What shall I ask it, Lord Farr?
I want to know more about how they're defending this place, Bolvanger.
Without even having to think about it, she found her fingers moving the hands to point to the helmet, the griffin, and the crucible, and felt her mind settle into the right meanings like a complicated diagram in three dimensions. At once the needle began to swing round, back, round and on further, like a bee dancing its message to the hive. She watched it calmly, content not to know at first, but to know that a meaning was coming, and then it began to clear. She let it dance on until it was certain.
It's just like the witch's demon said, Lord Farr. There's a company of Tartars guarding the station, and they got wires all round it. They don't really expect to be attacked. That's what the symbol reader says. But, Lord Farr...
What, child?
It's a-telling me something else. In the next valley... There's a village by a lake where the folk are troubled by a ghost.
John Farr shook his head impatiently and said,
Well, that don't matter now. There's bound to be spirits of all kinds among these forests. Tell me again about them Tartars. How many, for instance? What are they armed with?
Lyra dutifully asked and reported the answer.
There's 60 men with rifles, and they got a couple of larger guns, sort of cannons. They got fire throwers, too, and their demons are all wolves. That's what it says.
That caused a stir among the old Egyptians, those who'd campaigned before.
The Sabirsk regiments have wolf demons?
Said one.
I never met fear, sir. We shall have to fight like tigers and consult the bear. He's a shrewd warrior, that one.
Lyra was impatient and said,
But Lord Farr, this ghost... I think it's the ghost of one of the kids.
Well, even if it is, Lyra, I don't know what anyone could do about it. 60 Sibirsk riflemen and fire throwers. Mr. Scoresby, step over here, if you would, for a moment.
While the aeronaut came to the sledge, Lyra slipped away and spoke to the bear.
Yorick, have you travelled this way before?
Once.
There's a village near, ain't there?
Over the ridge,
he said, looking up through the sparse trees.
Is it far?
For you or for me?
For me.
Too far. Not at all far for me.
How long would it take you to get there, then?
I could be there and back 3 times by next moonrise.
Because, Yorick, listen. I got this symbol reader that tells me things, you see. And it's told me that there's something important I've got to do over in that village. And Lord Far won't let me go there. He just wants to get on quick, and I know that's important too. But unless I go and find out what it is, we might not know what the gobblers are really doing.
The bear said nothing. He was sitting up like a human, his great paws folded in his lap, his dark eyes looking into hers down the length of his muzzle. He knew she wanted something. Pantalaimon spoke.
Can you take us there and catch up with the sledges later on?
I could, but I have given my word to Lord Far to obey him, not anyone else.
If I got his permission?
Then yes.
She turned and ran back through the snow.
Lord Far, if Yorick Bernison takes me over the ridge to the village, we can find out whatever it is and then catch the sledges up further on. He knows the route, and I wouldn't ask, except it's like what I did before, Far Decorum, you remember, with that chameleon. I didn't understand it then, but it was true, and we found out soon after. I got the same feeling now. I can't understand properly what it's saying, only I know it's important. And Yorick Bernison knows the way. He says he could get there and back 3 times by next moonrise. And I couldn't be safer than I'd be with him, could I? But he won't go without he gets Lord Far's permission.
There was a silence. Far Decorum sighed. John Far was frowning and his mouth inside the fur hood was set grimly. But before he could speak, the aeronaut put in,
Lord Far, if Yorick Bernison takes the little girl, she'll be as safe as if she was here with us. All bears are true, but I've known Yorick for years, and nothing under the sky will make him break his word. Give him the charge to take care of her, and he'll do it. Make no mistake. As for speed, he can lope for hours without tiring.
But why should not some men go?
Well, they'd have to walk, because you couldn't run a sledge over that ridge. Yorick Bernison can go faster than any man over that sort of country. And I'm light enough so he won't be slowed down. And I promise, Lord Far, I promise not to be any longer than I need, and not to give anything away about us, or to get in any danger.
You sure you need to do this? That Simbarida ain't playing the fool with you.
It never does, Lord Far, and I don't think it could.
John Far rubbed his chin.
Well, if it all comes out right, we'll have a piece more knowledge than we do now. Yorick Bernison, are you willing to do as this child bids?
I do your bidding, Lord Far. Tell me to take the child there, and I will.
Very well. You are to take her where she wishes to go and do as she bids. Lyra, I'm a commanding you now. You understand?
Yes, Lord Far.
You go and search for whatever it is, and when you've found it, you turn right round and come back. Yorick Bernison, we'll be a-travelling on by that time, so you'll have to catch us up.
The bear nodded his great head.
Are there any soldiers in the village?
He said to Lyra.
Will I need my armour? We shall be swifter without it.
No, I'm certain of that, Yorick. Thank you, Lord Far, and I promise I'll do just as you say.
Tony Costa gave her a strip of dried seal meat to chew, and with Pantalaimon as a mouse inside her hood, Lyra clambered onto the great bear's back, gripping his fur with her mittens and his narrow muscular back between her knees. His fur was wondrously thick, and the sense of immense power she felt was overwhelming. As if she weighed nothing at all, he turned and loped away in a long, swinging run up towards the ridge and into the low trees. It took some time before she was used to the movement, and then she felt a wild exhilaration. She was riding a bear, and the aurora was swaying above them in golden arcs and loops. And all around was the bitter Arctic cold and the immense silence of the north. Yorick Bernison's paws made hardly any sound as they padded forward through the snow. The trees were thin and stunted here, for they were on the edge of the tundra, but there were brambles and snagging bushes in the path. The bear ripped through them as if they were cobwebs. They climbed the low ridge, among outcrops of black rock, and were soon out of sight of the party behind them. Lyra wanted to talk to the bear, and if he had been human, she would already be on familiar terms with him. But he was so strange and wild and cold that she was shy, almost for the first time in her life. So as he loped along, his great legs swinging tirelessly, she sat with the movement and said nothing. Perhaps he preferred that anyway, she thought. She must seem a little prattling cub, only just past babyhood, in the eyes of an armored bear. She had seldom considered herself before, and found the experience interesting but uncomfortable, very like riding the bear, in fact. Jorek Birnesen was pacing swiftly, moving both legs on one side of his body at the same time, and rocking from side to side in a steady, powerful rhythm. She found she couldn't just sit, she had to ride actively. They had been travelling for an hour or more, and Lyra was stiff and sore but deeply happy, when Jorek Birnesen slowed down and stopped.
"Look up."
Lyra raised her eyes and had to wipe them with the inside of her wrist, for she was so cold that tears were blurring them. When she could see clearly, she gasped at the sight of the sky. The aurora had faded to a pallid, trembling glimmer, but the stars were as bright as diamonds, and across the great, dark, diamond-scattered vault, hundreds upon hundreds of tiny black shapes were flying out of the east and south towards the north.
"Are they birds?"
"They are witches."
"Witches? What are they doing?"
"Flying to war, maybe. I have never seen so many at one time."
"Do you know any witches, Yorick?"
"I have served some, and fought some, too. This is a sight to frighten Lord Fa. If they are flying to the aid of your enemies, you should all be afraid."
"Lord Fa wouldn't be frightened. You ain't afraid, are you?"
"Not yet. When I am, I shall master the fear. But we had better tell Lord Fa about the witches, because the men might not have seen them."
He moved on more slowly, and she kept watching the sky until her eyes splintered again with tears of cold, and she saw no end to the numberless witches flying north. Finally, Jorek Birnesen stopped and said,
"There is the village."
They were looking down a broken, rugged slope towards a cluster of wooden buildings beside a wide stretch of snow as flat as could be, which Lyra took to be the frozen lake. A wooden jetty showed her she was right. They were no more than 5 minutes from the place.
"What do you want to do?"
Lyra slipped off his back and found it hard to stand. Her face was stiff with cold and her legs were shaky, but she clung to his fur and stamped until she felt stronger.
"There's a child or a ghost or something down in that village, or maybe near it. I don't know for certain. I want to go and find him and bring him back to Lord Far and the others if I can. I thought he was a ghost, but the symbol reader might be telling me something I can't understand."
"If he is outside, he had better have some shelter."
"I don't think he's dead,"
said Lyra, but she was far from sure. The alethiometer had indicated something uncanny and unnatural, which was alarming. But who was she? Lord Asriel's daughter. And who was under her command? A mighty bear. How could she possibly show any fear?
"Let's just go and look."
She clambered on his back again, and he set off down the broken slope, walking steadily and not pacing any more. The dogs of the village smelled or heard or sensed them coming and began to howl frightfully, and the reindeer in their enclosure moved about nervously, their antlers clashing like dry sticks. In the still air, every movement could be heard for a long way. As they reached the first of the houses, Lyra looked to the right and left, peering hard into the dimness, for the aurora was fading and the moon still far from rising. Here and there a light flickered under a snow-thick roof, and Lyra thought she saw pale faces behind some of the window panes and imagined their astonishment to see a child riding a great white bear. At the centre of the little village there was an open space next to the jetty, where boats had been drawn up, mounds under the snow. The noise of the dogs was deafening, and just as Lyra thought it must have wakened everyone, a door opened and a man came out holding a rifle. His wolverine demon leapt onto the woodstack beside the door, scattering snow. Lyra slipped down at once and stood between him and Jorek Birnesen, conscious that she had told the bear there was no need for his armour. The man spoke in words she couldn't understand. Jorek Birnesen replied in the same language, and the man gave a little moan of fear.
"He thinks we are devils. What shall I say?"
"Tell him we're not devils, but we've got friends who are. And we're looking for just a child. A strange child. Tell him that."
As soon as the bear had said that, the man pointed to the right, indicating some place further off, and spoke quickly. Jorek Birnesen said,
"He asks if we have come to take the child away. They are afraid of it. They have tried to drive it away, but it keeps coming back."
"Tell him we'll take it away with us, but they were very bad to treat it like that. Where is it?"
The man explained, gesticulating fearfully. Lyra was afraid he'd fire his rifle by mistake, but as soon as he'd spoken, he hastened inside his house and shut the door. Lyra could see faces at every window.
"Where is the child?"
"In the fish house,"
the bear told her, and turned to pad down towards the jetty. Lyra followed. She was horribly nervous. The bear was making for a narrow wooden shed, raising his head to sniff this way and that, and when he reached the door he stopped and said,
"In there."
Lyra's heart was beating so fast she could hardly breathe. She raised her hand to knock at the door and then, feeling that that was ridiculous, took a deep breath to call out, but realized that she didn't know what to say. Oh, it was so dark now. She should have brought a lantern. There was no choice, and anyway, she didn't want the bear to see her being afraid. He had spoken of mastering his fear. That was what she'd have to do. She lifted the strap of reindeer hide holding the latch in place and tugged hard against the frost, binding the door shut. It opened with a snap. She had to kick aside the snow piled against the foot of the door before she could pull it open, and Pantalaimon was no help, running back and forth in his ermine shape, a white shadow over the white ground, uttering little frightened sounds.
"Pan, for God's sake, be a bat! Go and look for me!"
But he wouldn't, and he wouldn't speak either. She had never seen him like this except once, when she and Roger in the crypt at Jordan had moved the demon coins into the wrong skulls. He was even more frightened than she was. As for Yorick Birnison, he was lying in the snow nearby, watching in silence.
"Come out!"
Lyra said as loud as she dared.
"Come out!"
Not a sound came in answer. She pulled the door a little wider, and Pantalaimon leapt up into her arms, pushing and pushing at her in his cat form, and said,
"Go away! Don't stay here! Oh, Lyra, go now! Turn back!"
Trying to hold him still, she was aware of Yorick Birnison getting to his feet, and turned to see a figure hastening down the track from the village, carrying a lantern. When he came close enough to speak, he raised the lantern and held it to show his face, an old man with a broad, lined face and eyes nearly lost in a thousand wrinkles. His demon was an Arctic fox. He spoke, and Yorick Birnison said,
"He says that it's not the only child of that kind. He's seen others in the forest. Sometimes they die quickly, sometimes they don't die. This one is tough, he thinks. But it would be better for him if he died."
"Ask him if I can borrow his lantern."
The bear spoke, and the man handed it to her at once, nodding vigorously. She realized that he'd come down in order to bring it to her and thanked him, and he nodded again and stood back, away from her and the hut, and away from the bear. Lyra thought suddenly, what if the child is Roger? And she prayed with all her force that it wouldn't be. Pantalaimon was clinging to her, an ermine again, his little claws hooked deep into her anorak. She lifted the lantern high and took a step into the shed, and then she saw what it was that the oblation board was doing, and what was the nature of the sacrifice the children were having to make. The little boy was huddled against the wooden drying rack where hung row upon row of gutted fish, all as stiff as boards. He was clutching a piece of fish to him as Lyra was clutching Pantalaimon with her left hand hard against her heart. But that was all he had, a piece of dried fish, because he had no demon at all. The gobblers had cut it away. That was intercision, and this was a severed child. Chapter 13. Fencing. Her first impulse was to turn and run, or to be sick. A human being with no demon was like someone without a face, or with their ribs laid open and their heart torn out, something unnatural and uncanny that belonged to the world of night ghasts, not the waking world of sense. So Lyra clung to Pantalaimon, and her head swam and her gorge rose, and cold as the night was, a sickly sweat moistened her flesh with something colder still.
"Retta,"
said the boy.
"You got my Retta?"
Lyra was in no doubt what he meant.
"No,"
she said in a voice as frail and frightened as she felt. Then,
"What's your name?"
"Tony Magarios. Where's Retta?"
"I don't know,"
she began, and swallowed hard to govern her nausea.
"The gobblers..."
But she couldn't finish. She had to go out of the shed and sit down by herself in the snow, except that, of course, she wasn't by herself. She was never by herself, because Pantalaimon was always there. Oh, to be cut from him as this little boy had been parted from his Ratter, the worst thing in the world. She found herself sobbing, and Pantalaimon was whimpering too, and in both of them there was a passionate pity and sorrow for the half-boy. Then she got to her feet again.
"Come on. Tony, come out. We're going to take you somewhere safe."
There was a stir of movement in the fish house, and he appeared at the door, still clutching his dried fish. He was dressed in warm enough garments, a thickly padded and quilted coal silk anorak and fur boots, but they had a second-hand look and didn't fit well. In the wider light outside that came from the faint trails of the aurora and the snow-covered ground, he looked more lost and piteous even than he had at first, crouching in the lantern light by the fish racks. The villager who'd brought the lantern had retreated a few yards and called down to them. Yorick Birnison interpreted.
He says you must pay for that fish.
Lyra felt like telling the bear to kill him, but she said,
We're taking the child away for them. They can afford to give one fish to pay for that.
The bear spoke. The man muttered but didn't argue. Lyra set his lantern down in the snow and took the half-boy's hand to guide him to the bear. He came helplessly, showing no surprise and no fear at the great white beast standing so close. And when Lyra helped him to sit on Yorick's back, all he said was,
I dunno where my ratter is.
No, nor do we, Tony. But we'll punish the gobblers. We'll do that, I promise. Yorick, is it all right if I sit up there too?
My armor weighs far more than children.
So she scrambled up behind Tony and made him cling to the long, stiff fur. And Pantalaimon sat inside her hood, warm and close and full of pity. Lyra knew that Pantalaimon's impulse was to reach out and cuddle the little half-child, to lick him and gentle him and warm him, as his own demon would have done. But the great taboo prevented that, of course. They rose through the village and up towards the ridge, and the villagers' faces were open with horror and a kind of fearful relief at seeing that hideously mutilated creature taken away by a girl and a great white bear. In Lyra's heart, revulsion struggled with compassion, and compassion won. She put her arms around the skinny little form to hold him safe. The journey back to the main party was colder and harder and darker, but it seemed to pass more quickly for all that. Yorick Birnison was tireless, and Lyra's riding became automatic, so that she was never in danger of falling off. The cold body in her arms was so light that in one way he was easy to manage, but he was inert. He sat stiffly without moving as the bear moved, so in another way he was difficult, too. From time to time the half-boy spoke.
What's that you said?
I says, is she gonna know where I am?
Yeah, she'll know. She'll find you, and we'll find her. Hold on tight now, Tony. It ain't far from here.
The bear loped onwards. Lyra had no idea how tired she was until they caught up with the Egyptians. The sledges had stopped to rest the dogs, and suddenly there they all were, Fardacorum, Lord Far, Lee Scoresby, all lunging forward to help and then falling back silent as they saw the other figure with Lyra. She was so stiff that she couldn't even loosen her arms around his body, and John Far himself had to pull them gently open and lift her off.
Gracious God, what is this? Lyra, child, what have you found?
He's called Tony,
she mumbled through frozen lips.
And they cut his demon away. That's what the gobblers do.
The men held back, fearful. But the bear spoke to Lyra's weary amazement, chiding them.
Shame on you. Think what this child has done. You might not have more courage, but you should be ashamed to show less.
You're right, Yorick Birnison,
said John Farr and turned to give orders.
Build that fire up and heat some soup for the child, for both children. Fardacorum, is your shelter rigged?
It is, John. Bring her over and we'll get her warm.
And the little boy?
Said someone else.
He can eat and get warm, even if...
Lyra was trying to tell John Farr about the witches, but they were all so busy and she was so tired. After a confusing few minutes full of lantern light, wood smoke, figures hurrying to and fro, she felt a gentle nip on her ear from Pantalaimon's ermine teeth, and woke to find the bear's face a few inches from hers.
The witches,
Pantalaimon whispered.
I called Yorick.
Oh, yeah. Yorick, thank you for taking me there and back. I might not remember to tell Lord Far about the witches, so you better do that instead of me.
She heard the bear agree, and then she fell asleep properly. When she woke up, it was as close to daylight as it was ever going to get. The sky was pale in the southeast, and the air was suffused with a grey mist through which the Egyptians moved like bulky ghosts, loading sledges and harnessing dogs to the traces. She saw it all from the shelter on Fardacorum's sledge, inside which she lay under a heap of furs. Pantalaimon was fully awake before she was, trying the shape of an Arctic fox before reverting to his favourite ermine. Yorick Birnison was asleep in the snow nearby, his head on his great paws. But Fardacorum was up and busy, and as soon as he saw Pantalaimon emerge, he limped across to wake Lyra properly. She saw him coming and sat up to speak.
Fardacorum, I know what it was that I couldn't understand. The alethiometer kept saying bird and not, and that didn't make sense, because it meant no demon, and I didn't see how it could be. What is it?
Lyra, I'm afraid to tell you this after what you've done, but that little boy died an hour ago. He couldn't settle, he couldn't stay in one place. He kept asking after his demon where she was she a coming soon and all. And he kept such a tight hold on that bare old piece of fish as if... Oh, I can't speak of it, child. But he closed his eyes finally and fell still. And that was the first time he looked peaceful. For he was like any other dead person then, with their demon gone in the course of nature. They've been a-trying to dig a grave for him, but the earth's bound like iron. So John Farr ordered a fire built, and they're going to cremate him, so as not to have him despoiled by carrion eaters. Child, you did a brave thing and a good thing, and I'm proud of you. Now we know what terrible wickedness those people are capable of, we can see our duty plainer than ever. What you must do is rest and eat, because you fell asleep too soon to restore yourself last night, and you have to eat in these temperatures to stop yourself getting weak.
He was fussing around, tucking the furs into place, tightening the tension rope across the body of the sledge, running the traces through his hands to untangle them.
Far decorum, where is the little boy now? Have they burned him yet?
No, Lyra. He's a lying back there.
I want to go and see him.
He couldn't refuse her that, for she'd seen worse than a dead body, and it might calm her. So with Pantalaimon as a white hare bounding delicately at her side, she trudged along the line of sledges to where some men were piling brushwood. The boy's body lay under a checkered blanket beside the path. She knelt and lifted the blanket in her mittened hands. One man was about to stop her, but the others shook their heads. Pantalaimon crept close as Lyra looked down on the poor, wasted face. She slipped her hand out of the mitten and touched his eyes. They were marble cold, and Far Decorum had been right. Poor little Tony Macarius was no different from any other human whose demon had departed in death. Oh, if they took Pantalaimon from her! She swept him up and hugged him as if she meant to press him right into her heart. And all little Tony had was his pitiful piece of fish. Where was it? She pulled the blanket down. It was gone. She was on her feet in a moment, and her eyes flashed fury at the men nearby.
Where's his fish?
They stopped, puzzled, unsure what she meant, though some of their demons knew and looked at one another. One of the men began to grin uncertainly.
Don't you dare laugh! I'll tear your lungs out if you laugh at him! That's all he had to cling on to! Just an old dried fish! That's all he had for a demon to love and be kind to! Who's took it from him? Where's it gone?
Pantalaimon was a snarling snow leopard, just like Lord Asriel's demon, but she didn't see that. All she saw was right and wrong.
Easy, Lyra,
said one man.
Easy, child.
Who's took it?
She flared again, and the Egyptian took a step back from her passionate fury.
I didn't know,
said another man apologetically.
I thought it was just what he'd been eating. I took it out of his hand because I thought it was more respectful. That's all, Lyra.
Then where is it?
The man said uneasily.
Not thinking he had a need for it. I gave it to my dogs. I do beg your pardon.
It ain't my pardon you need, it's his,
she said, and turned at once to kneel again and laid her hand on the dead child's icy cheek. Then an idea came to her, and she fumbled inside her furs. The cold air struck through as she opened her anorak, but in a few seconds she had what she wanted and took a gold coin from her purse before wrapping herself close again.
I want to borrow your knife,
she said to the man who'd taken the fish, and when he let her have it, she said to Pantalaimon,
what was her name?
He understood, of course, and said,
Ratta.
She held the coin tight in her left mittened hand, and, holding the knife like a pencil, scratched the lost demon's name deeply into the gold.
I hope that'll do, if I provide for you like a Jordan scholar,
she whispered to the dead boy, and forced his teeth apart to slip the coin into his mouth. It was hard, but she managed it, and managed to close his jaw again. Then she gave the man back his knife, and turned in the morning twilight to go back to Far Decorum. He gave her a mug of soup straight off the fire, and she sipped it greedily.
What are we going to do about them witches, Far Decorum? I wonder if your witch was one of them.
My witch? I wouldn't presume that far, Lyra. They might be going anywhere. There's all kinds of concerns that plague on the life of witches. Things invisible to us. Mysterious sicknesses they fall prey to, which we shrug off. Causes of war, quite beyond our understanding. Joys and sorrows, bound up with the flowering of tiny plants up on the tundra. But I wish I'd seen them a-flying, Lyra. I wish I'd been able to see a sight like that. Now, drink up all that soup. Do you want some more? There's some pan bread a-cooking, too. Eat up, child, because we're on our way soon.
The food revived Lyra, and presently the chill at her soul began to melt. With the others, she went to watch the little half-child laid on his funeral pyre, and bowed her head and closed her eyes for John Farr's prayers. And then the men sprinkled cold spirit and set matches to it, and it was blazing in a moment. Once they were sure he was safely burned, they set off to travel again. It was a ghostly journey. Snow began to fall early on, and soon the world was reduced to the grey shadows of the dogs ahead, the lurching and creaking of the sledge, the biting cold, and a swirling sea of big flakes only just darker than the sky and only just lighter than the ground. Through it all, the dogs continued to run, tails high, breath puffing steam. North and further north they ran, while the pallid noontide came and went and the twilight wrapped itself again around the world. They stopped to eat and drink and rest in a fold of the hills and to get their bearings, and while John Farr talked to Lee Scoresby about the way they might best use the balloon, Lyra thought of the spy fly, and she asked Father Coram what had happened to the smoke-leaf tin he'd trapped it in.
"I've got it tucked away tight. It's down in the bottom of that kit bag. But there's nothing to see. I soldered it shut on board ship like I said I would. I don't know what we're going to do with it, to tell you the truth. Maybe we could drop it down a fire mine. Maybe that would settle it. But you needn't worry, Lyra. While I've got it, you're safe."
The first chance she had, she plunged her arm down into the stiffly frosted canvas of the kit bag and brought up the little tin. She could feel the buzz it was making before she touched it.